This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tom McNeil. European Union leaders agreed on a set of sanctions against Belarus, including banning its airlines from using the airports and airspace of the 27-nation bloc. The action comes amid fury over the forced diversion of a passenger jet flying between two EU countries in order to arrest an opposition journalist, and what EU leaders have called a brazen hijacking of Irish carrier Ryanair's plane flying from Greece to Lithuania on Sunday. They demanded the immediate release of Roman Protasevich, a key foe of the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko. A brief video of Protasevich was shown on Belarusian state television, in which he said his treatment in custody was maximally correct and according to law. Meanwhile, the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, has signed a law sharply restricting news media activities and allowing them to be shut down without a court hearing. It also allows the information ministry to order a media outlet's closure. Previously, media closures required a court decision. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is now spending time in the Middle East to press the Israelis, Palestinians, and regional players to build on last week's Gaza ceasefire by laying the groundwork for an eventual resumption in long-stalled peace talks. President Joe Biden announced Blinken will have a short visit to Israel, the West Bank, Jordan, and Egypt for what will be the Biden administration's highest-level in-person meetings on the crisis that erupted earlier this month. Blinken's primary goal will be to shore up the ceasefire in the hope that will hold and discuss an urgent infusion of humanitarian assistance into Gaza and stress the need for an end to intra-communal violence. This is VOA News. The World Health Organization admits missteps in the response to COVID-19. AP correspondent Rita Foley.
The WHO opened its annual meeting working on a draft resolution that acknowledges missteps in the response to COVID-19. There are serious shortcomings, it said, in the world's ability to prepare for and prevent health emergencies. Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus led a round of applause for healthcare workers and then said the world remains in a very dangerous situation. What to do? One thing, he said, get vaccines to all countries faster. In his words, a small group of countries that make and buy the majority of the world's vaccines control the fate of the rest of the world. I'm Rita Foley.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the State Department are warning Americans against all travel to Japan because of a surge in coronavirus cases in the country as it prepares to host the Olympics in just 2 months. The Twin Alerts issued Monday don't ban U.S. citizens from visiting the country, but they could have an impact on insurance rates for travelers and may factor into decisions by Olympic athletes and spectators on whether to compete in or attend the Games. The White House and Kremlin are working to arrange a face-to-face meeting next month between Presidents Biden and Putin. AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
A U.S. official familiar with the planning says National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan's meeting with his Russian counterpart in Geneva, which another official says is expected to be where the two presidents will meet. Both sides are looking at a summit in mid-June at the end of President Biden's first foreign trip to Europe. White House spokeswoman Jen Psaki says she's not ready to announce anything just yet.
We're still working on the details.
At the last leaders' summit in July 2018, President Trump refused to side with U.S. intelligence agencies when Putin denied Russian interference in the 2016 election. Sagar Magani, Washington.
AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports the Department of Homeland Security Inspector General says the Trump administration forced migrant parents to leave the United States without their children.
The report contradicts claims by administration officials that migrant parents were willingly leaving their children behind while the parents were deported. The American Civil Liberties Union says some parents were misled, told their child would join them on the plane, but that didn't happen. While the Biden administration is working to reunite hundreds of separated families, it's also trying to house migrant children who are now crossing over the southern border alone.
That is AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reporting via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Uganda has a new Speaker of Parliament, defeating the first female to ever hold the post.
We have a variety from where we can choose leaders, and our top organ picked on Honorable Olanya, and our role as the party was to ensure that we popularize him.
There were frequent aftershocks following Saturday's volcanic eruption in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. A traditional chief in Zimbabwe calls for exhumation of Robert Mugabe's body. Sierra Leone's government responds to a mental health report by Amnesty International. And there's a call for an independent investigation into recent military aircraft crash in Nigeria.
In the last 3 months, 3 NAV jets have crashed. So one begins to wonder, can this be coincidence? And this is why we believe that any investigation that is done within government may not be completely transparent.
And the biggest danger to the African manatee. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A spokesperson for Uganda's ruling National Resistance Movement, the NRM, says the party has done a lot in promoting women participation in politics. Rogers Mulindwa says no one should lecture Uganda on women's participation in politics. This comes after Rebecca Kadaga, who has been Speaker of the Ugandan Parliament for the last 10 years, was defeated Monday by Jacob Ulanya. A week prior to Monday's election, President Yoweri Museveni had complained about corruption in parliament. According to the Uganda Monitor, some central executive members of the NRM had accused Kadaga of personalizing parliament during the 10 years that she served as speaker. Spokesperson Mulindwa says the NRM believes in democracy as one of its core principles and that President Museveni had no influence in the election.
There is nothing special about this election. Because the National Resistance Movement is not short of manpower, we have a variety from where we can choose leaders, and our top organ picked on Honorable Olanya, and our role as the party was to ensure that we popularize him, we talk to everybody to give him support, and the results have clearly indicated that we made the right choice because he got 310 votes out of the 524. And then for the Deputy Speaker, Honorable Anita Monk. So this is a clear indication that the National Resistance Movement is still very popular in this country. And our opposition is still a weak side. They need to reorganize themselves.
Now, what do you say to people who might say, well, across the border in Kenya, they just chose a female Chief Justice, and you are getting rid of a female Speaker of Parliament?
I think in the whole world, we are one of the few countries that promote women participation in politics. In Africa, we could have produced the first Vice President, Dr. Special Zakani Zuba, one time. We have been having a speaker. I don't know whether there is another country in Africa or there are more than three that have been having female speakers for the last 10 years. So we cannot be lectured on gender issues. And as we talk now, yes, the speaker is a male, but the deputy speaker is a female. The last 10 years, it has been the other way around.
What role do you think President Museveni played? Because I was reading prior to Monday's election, I was reading that there had been some heated campaign within the party for this position. And at one point, President Museveni had expressed concern about corruption in parliament. How much role did this play in her defeat?
Of course, the president, as national chairperson of the NRM, had advised the people not to campaign until the party comes out to announce time for expression of interest. But people, defied that, and they went ahead to start the campaigns. Both Olanya and Kadaga were out conversing for support until only yesterday that the Central Executive Committee pronounced itself on who is the official flag bearer. And we worked within 15 hours to make sure these flag bearers can win the final day. As a party, of course, we believe so much in democracy as one of the core principles of NRM. And we have allowed democracy to be at the play. We have the leaders because of the democracy. There is no influence the president had no interference with the process. Actually, he took a back seat, and the vice chairperson was the one presiding over these meetings. And he has never been seen or heard any single time saying maybe you should vote this one or you should vote the other one. So I think this is really a very good story for us. And the results put us at they are pointing at a bright future for this ruling party.
Thank you for taking time to talk with me.
Thank you, my brother.
Rogers Mulindwa is spokesperson for the National Resistance Movement Party of Uganda. He was speaking with us from Kampala. A traditional chief has ordered former Zimbabwean First Lady Grace Mugabe to exhume her husband's remains at a family homestead in the Mashonaland region and rebury them at the National Heroes Acre. Chief Zvimba convened a traditional court last Thursday, and in a letter written to Mrs. Mugabe on Monday, he claimed that Mrs. Mugabe violated local cultural norms by laying Mugabe to rest at his homestead in Kutama. The chief fined Mrs. Mugabe 5 cattle and a goat for allegedly violating traditional burial rites. Chief Zvimba did not respond to calls for comment. Neither was Information Minister Monica Muzvangwa. ZANU-PF Regional Chairperson of the Americas, Regis Vusanga, says the ruling party has nothing to do with Mugabe's exhumation.
Not sure, because I have not seen the judgment, but I have heard a number of people calling me and telling me that it's foolish that we must exhume the body by the 1st of July. So that ruling to us, you know, it's a ruling against the widow. And the widow has got nothing to do with the burying of her husband. It was the Mugabe needed family, Kargamo needed family, who are responsible. But the people that made that judgment, that decision to bury where he buried. So this judgment, you know, it's irrelevant if you ask me. In any case, Chief Zvimba is not the chief who presides over Kutama area. Chief Teperere is the one who presides over Kutama, with Chisora as his headman and Kutama as his story. To jump all these people and as this he is a paramount chief, and there is nothing that is called a paramount chief in the traditional leaders act. Therefore, you know, if that is their belief, while they are talking between themselves as chiefs, that is just their talk. But the law does not provide for a paramount chief.
So what are you going to do? Because there's a deadline here to you know, for the government to move in. What are you going to do?
No, our government is a responsible government. It has to talk to us to the immediate family. Failure, we, you know, we simply go to court.
And in this case, the government, I believe, actually assisted in the burial of the late president, former
exactly.
president.
You know, exactly. And we there was no agreement with the government. The delays were caused by the disagreements that were within the family itself, not with the government. The government accepted when we said we're burying in Zimba, they accepted and they assisted. And on the day of the burial, Chief Teperere was there at the burial.
Mm-hmm.
So if now if you read the Independent of last week, you then find that you know there was a meeting sometime in September.
Mm-hmm.
The chiefs went to the president and presented the matter that we want to exhume him and bury him properly. Okay? And the president asked them a question that, how are you going to deal with the people, the reaction of the people and things like that? And he warned them to think twice about this.
Okay.
So all they want to do is to be relevant to President Mnangagwa. To say, you know, your wish that you wanted him to be buried at the Heroes Acre, we are now going to facilitate that wish be fulfilled. It's not irrelevant.
But as the Mugabe family, you are saying no?
No. You are saying no.
So is there any way that you can block the government if it wants to move in, exhume the remains and rebury them somewhere?
No, the government cannot move in.
That was Leo Mugabe, the late former Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe's nephew. You're speaking with Gibbs Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service. Frequent aftershocks have followed Saturday's eruption of the volatile Nyiragongo volcano in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, sending more than 250 anxious people fleeing to neighboring Rwanda. When the eruption occurred, killing at least 15 people, around 10,000 Congolese took refuge in western Rwanda's Rubavu district. Many others slept outdoors rather than take the risk of their homes collapsing on them. Eugene Uwimana has details from the Rwanda DRC border.
It's a catastrophic moment for Goma and Rubavu residents. First, the eruption around 7 p.m. Saturday, then quakes at least every 10 minutes. Between physical damage and distress, people are trying to cope. This man says you cannot really be sure that these things are over. He says they went back home, believing that the eruption had stopped. But all of a sudden, quakes began. And he says we did the one last option we had, to flee. He says even here on the Rwandan side, they are not sleeping in the house either. Anytime something bad can happen. He says if he had everywhere else, he would really leave in a moment. Although lava flows stopped short of the center of Goma, a city of 2 million residents, housing the roads on both sides of the border have been severely damaged, with cracks in the floors and walls. No estimates were available on a property damage. Jean-Marie Vianney Gatabazi, Rwanda's Minister of Local Government, who has been in the Rubavu district since the eruption began, said officials are ready to accept other Congolese who flee for safety.
As of now, only scientists can know whether the volcano had permanently stopped erupting or if there are still other consequences for Goma residents. As far as the Rwandan government is concerned, we are on standby to receive them if they need a refuge again.
Even for scientists, it's unclear where the volcano, which is considered among the world's most dangerous, will calm down. The region of Goma in DRC is home to two active volcanoes, Nyamulagira and Nyiragongo. Nyiragongo's last major eruption came in 2002, when about 250 people were killed and 120,000 others were left homeless. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Rubavu, Western Rwanda.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 25th. A political pressure group in Nigeria is calling for an independent team of aviation accident experts to thoroughly investigate the recent military plane crash that killed Chief of Army Staff General Ibrahim Atahiru and other officers. The group called Concerned Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and the Rule of Law Initiative is also calling for an immediate suspension of all military aircraft until the inquiry determines the causes of the recent crashes. The plane carrying the former army chief went down near the Kaduna airport in the country's north on Friday. Deji Adeyanju is the convener of Concerned Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that only an independent inquiry without political influence can determine the actual cause of the tragedies.
It is one air crash too many because in the last 3 months, three NAV jets have crashed, you know, in the country. So one begins to wonder, can this be coincidence? Because there seems to be something amiss. And this is why we believe that any investigation that is done within government, you know, may not be completely transparent. And that's why we are calling on the federal government to engage an independent aircraft expert who will conduct this investigation, you know, thoroughly and to ensure neutrality and impartiality of the investigation so that the root cause or causes of these air crashes, you know, will be identified and solutions will be profiled. It's in the interest of the president and those who are key leaders of the government to ensure that if something is amiss, that they themselves do not become victims of this.
Deji, are you suggesting there's a nefarious activity or somebody is behind this crash? Some people are saying this was just an accident.
I am implying that there's somebody behind this accident. That is not an accident. How can there be three plane crashes, all military jets, three of them in 3 months? And how can we call that an accident? It's definitely not an accident. Again, you know our position on saying that there are too many extremists and their sympathizers around and in this government. And it gives room to many of us who believe that our security agencies are compromised and that people who are behind these things, you know, are finding it very easy, you know, to carry out this act. So for me, I do not believe that this is an accident. I do not believe that this is a coincidence. I believe that this is an intentional act and that the president, the vice president, and key other members of government must be very, very mindful of what is going on. And they should suspend all flight air travels for now until an independent investigation has been done and the report is out. Thank you.
But they are suggesting that an investigation has been launched. Why are you not satisfied with the current investigation announced into the crash?
Yes, we are not satisfied because any investigation that is within government, you know, we suspect, you know, that this could be a deliberate jihad that is going on in the country. So we don't want the president, the vice president, and other top government officials to be victims of whatever is going on. But something is definitely wrong somewhere. Something is amiss. And we are just simply saying that the government should get experts externally who are independent, who cannot be easily influenced, to conduct the investigations. Thank you.
So where does Nigeria go from here in view of the recent plane crashes for which you are demanding an independent inquiry?
The way forward is simple. You know that the president must begin to understand that the war against Boko Haram cannot be won if they continue to pardon Boko Haram members, if they continue to wine and dine with extremists in government. It cannot all go well for the country. So the president must take decisive steps against terror.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener of the Concerned Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and the Rule of Law. We are speaking with viewers Peter Clotty. Sierra Leone's health minister says his government is doing all it can to meet the mental health needs of its citizens. But Dr. Austin Demby says the needs far surpass what the government can do. This comes as Amnesty International releases a report today, Tuesday, on mental health in Sierra Leone as a result of the country's civil war, Ebola, and now the coronavirus pandemic. The group says there is a lack of government spending on mental health, insufficient donor support, and a shortage of skilled mental health professionals. Health Minister Dr. Austin Demby says the government is looking for private partners and philanthropic organizations to join the government in tackling the country's mental health crisis.
I think the main message there is the government is doing its very best to address mental health issues nationally. So I think the whole nation was traumatized by Ebola, and I think what the government is trying to do is to build institutional capacity and capabilities to be able to respond to that need. But the need far surpasses what the government could do on its own. And so we're looking at private partners and philanthropic organizations, international partners to join with us and really have just a massive engagement around mental health in the country. I think the Ebola survivors are a special case because the trauma associated with that was so profound. And we have to look for ways to be able to address their needs. We have over 4,000 registered survivors here in Sierra Leone. We're looking for opportunities to be able to provide a broad range of services for them, including mental health services. But right now, the resources are fairly limited, and the facilities we have mostly is in Freetown area, and the workforce that's required for national coverage is much bigger than we could provide right now. But we're looking to make sure that we could change that narrative in Sierra Leone by both government investment as well as international partner support.
Across the border in Liberia, one of my reporters was looking at a report about people with handicap, and similar thing came up where they think that the government does not pay attention to their problems. Same thing this report is saying about insufficient government spending to pay attention to people with mental health.
About 3-4 years ago, the government investment in the health sector was about 7% of GDP. The government has dramatically increased that to about close to 12% of GDP. The government puts a premium on human capacity development, covering a broad range of making everybody be their true full potential. This includes handicapped Sierra Leoneans, this includes Ebola survivors, this includes school children and the general community. So I think the government is doing a lot, but the need is so huge, the need is so great that we will encourage, we'll solicit, we'll ask for as much additional help as we can to supplement what the government is doing, to be able to expand services beyond Kisii Psychiatric Hospital that we have to cover a national program. We're also expanding the technical skills that we have around psychiatric management. We're actually launching very soon a residency program so you could attract doctors with real expertise in psychiatry to be involved in this space as we look to expand services across the board. But as I said before, the need is much, much greater than what we could afford. And I think getting additional help, getting some partnerships of interested parties will go a long way towards us satisfying the needs for all of the subgroups that have mental health issues.
Minister, you've been very kind. Thank you very much. It's so nice to talk with you.
My pleasure, sir.
Dr. Austin Demby is Sierra Leone's health minister. You're speaking with us from the capital, Freetown. Researchers conducting threat assessment on the African manatee see dams as one of the animal's biggest dangers. Dr. Lucy Keith Diame, a marine mammal biologist in Senegal who runs African Aquatic Conservation, spoke to Ricky Stryak about this study.
And our big focus right now is threat assessments. You know, we've been trying to study manatees in all these countries and mostly realizing that they're under severe pressure from illegal hunting, fisheries bycatch, and in Senegal, dams that they get either trapped behind or crushed in the dam structures. We are doing threat assessment studies where we're basically trying to document every single manatee that dies or is captured in five countries for 3 years. So Senegal, the Gambia, Nigeria, Cameroon, and Democratic Republic of the Congo. And I'm actually about to start in Guinea as well. The take-home message is that we're in our third year of that, and we are realizing that there's an enormous number of manatees dying, sadly, that Nigeria is absolutely the worst country for manatees that we've ever seen. They're just being slaughtered there, and it's surprising there are any left. But the good news is that in Senegal, we have identified very little hunting. We know of a couple places where it's still occasionally happening, but it's not the main threat here. The biggest threats for manatees in Senegal are fisheries bycatch, meaning that a fisherman is targeting something else, fish, and accidentally catches a manatee, but once they've caught it, they decide to eat it, and dams.
How far inland are we talking about when you talk about the Senegal River manatees?
So they go all the way into Mali, up the Senegal River. Really? They are all the way in. They go as far as Kai, Mali. At that point, you have a small dam. They also go up the Falémé River, which is sort of comes in from the Kédougou region. Yeah, they're there. They're all the way up the Gambia River. They literally traverse Senegal into Guinea in the Gambia River, although that's about to change because they're building a brand new hydroelectric dam in Kédougou.
How will that impact the manatee population?
Well, we don't really know much about that group that ascends the Gambia River. We know that they only do it in the rainy season because in the dry season, the river's not deep enough. But it will cut them off. So, you know, any manatees above that dam will be trapped in Guinea, and any manatees below the dam will not be able to go up that route anymore, that migratory route. So one would assume it cuts off wet season and food supply that they're seeking. So will they probably survive it? Well, the ones below the dam in the Kédougou side will, because they have other ways to swim out the river and find other food. The ones above it may not, because there's not many resources, and if the river dries out, they're just done.
That was Dr. Lucy Keith Diane, a marine mammal biologist who runs Africa Aquatic Conservation. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Senegal. And that's it for this Tuesday, May 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you will have a very good day.